months. In the words of the report presented by Captain Patou, the remaining pilots had simply reached the limit of physical and nervous wear and tear. Permission was granted to withdraw 14F from combat on May 1st. While the decision was, of course, inevitable, it left the French fighter force over Dien Bien Phu seriously depleted at an important moment. As General Deschaux's air staff for North Vietnam prepared the flight missions for May 2nd, the following picture emerged. A total of 28 fighters were available that morning, supplemented by 28 B-26 light bombers and 5 four-engine privateer bombers of the French Navy. One additional B-26 was detached for reconnaissance missions, and 7 Bearcats were part of Overseas Reconnaissance Squadron 80. The 21st and 23rd Artillery Air Observation Groups, based at Muang Sai, clearly showed how deadly the battle had become above Dien Bien Phu. Although there were 19 Moran Crickets available that morning, there remained only 8 crews to man them. The same was true for the 5 helicopters available that morning for medical evacuations in Laos. There were 5 aircraft available, but only 2 pilots. On the transport side, Colonel Nicot was also in trouble. His American civilian pilots had returned to the Dien Bien Phu run, but now his French civilian pilots spoke of refusing to fly the dangerous war missions. Here again the figures spoke for themselves. Out of a total of 43 flying boxcars available in North Vietnam, 34 were reported ready that morning to fly on Dien Bien Phu. However, only 14 completed their mission that day, with the others turning back for a variety of reasons, and during the next 2 days, when the French civilian pilots really walked out as they had threatened, the number of effectively completed C-119 missions dropped to 2 out of 30 and 7 out of 34, respectively. On the other hand, the score for the C-47s piloted by French Air Force crews during the period of May 2nd to 5th stood at 17 out of 17, 18 out of 25, 16 out of 29, 22 out of 27, and 25 out of 29. The orders for the day provided for 3 principal combat missions on Dien Bien Phu. A total of 13 bombers and 6 fighters would fly in direct support of the defenders of Dien Bien Phu. 4 bombers and 4 fighters would attack communist artillery bases, but could also be diverted to close air support in case of need on orders of the air liaison officer at Dien Bien Phu, Major Guerin. Finally, 10 fighters, 4 B-26s, and 2 privateers were to fly flak-suppressing missions in support of the transports. Of the 128 tons parachuted that day, probably less than 65 tons were found by the Dien Bien Phu garrison. In Hanoi, more fuel had been added to the flames of the Navarre-Cogny dispute. Cogny, who enjoyed excellent relations with the press, had during the preceding days given open vent to his pessimism as to the ultimate fate of the garrison at Dien Bien Phu, and with sufficient detail to permit Navarre to conclude that the information must have come from Cogny himself or from his closest associates. As was later confirmed by the journalists involved, the information had indeed come from Cogny himself. But at the time, the Northern Theater Commander refuted Navarre's admonition in several lengthy communications. In turn, Navarre sent Cogny on May 2nd a terse message. "Received your messages, to which no answer will be given. My position will be entirely maintained. Orders have been given to military security services to investigate indiscretions." Monday, May 3rd, 1954. It rained again at Dien Bien Phu in heavy, steady downpours, which now drowned defenders and besiegers alike. In fact, some of the senior officers at Dien Bien Phu now argued that the rains perhaps were a blessing in disguise for the garrison. For, as had become evident from interrogations of recent POWs, the enemy forces were also experiencing supply shortages, as even the coolies now were slowed down on the slippery slopes of jungle paths, and the progressive flooding of the low-lying communist trenches facing Claudine and Huguette now compelled the enemy to come out in the open for direct assault, thus becoming an easy target for the still very effective French automatic weapons and mortars. Apparently, the old military saying that when it rains on you, it also rains on the enemy, still held true. Except that the Viet Minh units, when badly mauled or exhausted from life in the forward trenches, were rotated without difficulty to safe rest camps deep in the forest only a few kilometers away, whereas the French had to stay put under the constant pounding of General Giap's artillery. If the latter was bothered by the rains, it certainly never showed it. At 0135, the airdrop of the lead elements of the 1st Colonial Parachute Battalion, BCP, began. While the last men of Captain Edma's company assembled in the darkness below, the supply drops also began. But the poor weather and the absence of the French civilian crews began to have a telling effect. Instead of the more than 100 tons required to break even, a total of 53 tons were dropped, and probably about 45 tons were collected. When 8 C-119s aborted their mission because of poor weather conditions, the message was greeted by howls of derision inside the fortress. But already on the previous day, Colonel Nicot, the head of the Air Transport Command, had warned Colonel Sauvignac that the difficulties of resupplying Dien Bien Phu were rapidly increasing. "My pilots experienced difficulties in finding the DZ and in seeing its markers. It is difficult to maintain a split-second course and to fly at night at only 300 meters above the bottom of the valley. The pilots are subjected to automatic weapons fire coming from all directions, and bursts of tracer bullets converge on the pilots, who are also blinded by Viet Minh illuminating shells, searchlights, and Bangalore torpedoes. The planes are also severely buffeted by the shock waves of the exploding enemy shells and by the friendly shells that are being fired. That type of acrobatic mission has become par for the course." Yet, taking advantage of the bad weather, the infantry remained active. One offensive patrol slipped out of C-3 and headed for Bonpapé, but it was stopped within 350 yards of its own position. On E-2, Coutant's foreign legionnaires remained as aggressive as ever. A command patrol slipped out of the position shortly after midnight, and soon a loud explosion proclaimed the excess of its exploit. The legionnaires had once more succeeded in blowing up a communist bunker with explosive charges. Still, Coutant was worried, for deep below E-2, the digging and scraping of the communist miners had almost completely stopped. If they were really digging a mine shaft to blow up E-2, then the moment must have come for them to begin to fill it with explosives. As dawn broke on May 3rd, French artillery began to lay down harassing fires on recently lost E-1, which the communists were now actively fortifying. On Claudine, where C-5 in particular now was strongly surrounded and under constant artillery and mortar bombardment, Captain Bienvaux, a paratroop officer on loan to the Foreign Legion who commanded on C-4, was wounded for a second time and stayed at his post. The underground hospitals were filled to the rafters anyway. His men and Captain Krumenacker's garrison of Moroccans, Thais, and Legionnaires on C-5 began to transform the drainage ditch into a combat trench connecting both strong points. Here, as in the drainage ditch near Sparrowhawk, men would soon fight in water up to their belts. In the northeastern corner of the fortress, the mixed band of paratroopers from the 2-1 RCP, the 6th BPC, and the 5th Vietnamese Parachute Battalion now could clearly see enemy troop movements on what used to be D-6 and E-1, but there was too little ammunition around to provoke a firefight. And the rains that day had a devastating effect even on the hill positions. On E-4, all hands were preoccupied with digging drainage ditches to keep the position from flooding altogether and to shore up the crumbling dugouts, which were disintegrating under the combined effect of the monsoon and Giap's artillery. In Hanoi, this was the moment for last-minute decisions. In the course of a staff conference in General Navarre's Hanoi office, General Cogny, Colonel de Crèvecoeur, who had flown in from Laos, and their staff officers were faced with some hard choices. According to the notes taken by Cogny's chief of staff, Colonel Bastiani, Navarre decided to parachute the whole 1st BPC to reinforce the garrison at Dien Bien Phu, in the hopes that its defense would thus be prolonged until the Geneva Conference arrived at a ceasefire in Indochina. If, however, that proved to be impossible, the French government had given him orders that there would be no capitulation at Dien Bien Phu, that is, no formal act of surrender, such as had finally taken place at Corregidor, Singapore, and even at Stalingrad. But Navarre still hoped that with the help of Operation Condor and the small commandos of mountain tribesmen and French cadres, a breakout of the able-bodied survivors would have a fighting chance. One question that was held in abeyance was whether the now arriving new parachute battalions, the 7th BPC and the 3rd BEP, who had been brought to Indochina by the U.S. Air Force airlift of huge Globemasters, should also be committed to Dien Bien Phu, or should rather be used to reinforce Colonel de Crèvecœur's units in Laos. Coigny was, from the beginning, dead set against Operation Albatross. He felt that any kind of sortie in the present exhausted state of the garrison could only lead to its total destruction and would in any case be branded as a rout. According to Ra, Coigny also thought that a prolonged resistance of the garrison would provide his own Red River Delta with the side benefit of tying down the Viet Minh divisions far from it and of leading them a little farther. In 1963, Coigny was still convinced that his position on a breakout had been correct under the circumstances. He termed Operation Condor a sinister comedy and asserted that a decision to resist on the spot to the end was to be credited to him. There will be neither capitulations nor rout under the pretext of a sortie. On the other hand, those units whose leaders would still think them capable of it would be given a chance to slip through the siege ring. As has been shown earlier, that decision, in fact, was no decision at all, since both Navarre and Coigny now left it up to General de Castri and his battalion commanders to decide when to attempt a breakout. And when de Castri finally made up his mind to try it, it came too late to become a rout, as Coigny feared. But it also came too late to save any significant number of French fighting men from the doomed garrison. In a short memorandum prepared to back up his commander during the conference, Colonel Bastiani stated that the defenders of Dien Bien Phu have up to now covered themselves with glory and are an object of admiration for the free world. The price of that unsullied glory came to 5,000 dead, 10,000 prisoners, and a lost war. Tuesday, May 4, 1954. A total of 7 out of 34 available C-119s and 16 out of 29 C-47s braved the monsoon and enemy flak that night to bring succor to Dien Bien Phu. The amount of supplies they managed to drop amounted to 57 tons with a 40% loss rate, but at least they managed to bring in Captain François Pendouf and a small headquarters element of the 1st Colonial Parachute Battalion and the 125 men of the complete 3rd Company of the battalion under Captain Jean Puget. Jean Puget deserves a special mention in the history of Dien Bien Phu for a variety of reasons. A regular cavalry captain of the French Army and a graduate of the French Military Academy, Puget had later requested a transfer to the paratroops in Indochina. Handsome and well-built, with the shapely chiseled features of an Indian chieftain, he had belonged during World War II to the toughest of all the French Maquis outfits in Savoy. After the liberation of France, he had returned to his branch of origin, the French Armored Cavalry, and had belonged, like de Castri, to the unit commanded by Navarre. Little wonder, then, that upon the latter's appointment to Indochina in May 1953, he would choose Puget as his aide-de-camp. And for months thereafter, official photographs would record, at a discreet distance behind the commander-in-chief, the tall and well-uniformed figure of the young officer. To be the aide of a senior commander is never an easy job, not because of the workload itself, which is often crushing, but because of the seemingly unbridgeable gap that opens between the man who lives in the shadow of the commander and his former associates. Past a certain point, the officer must make the decision either to tie his further career to the fortunes of the commander or to strike out for himself and accept the rebuffs of his associates until they realize that he again had become one of them. Puget, though I know him personally, I did not want to ask him that question, apparently made his choice. In January 1954, he requested a transfer to the 1st BPC. Navarre had given him his transfer without a word of opposition. But when the battalion, on February 13, 1954, made a combat jump to secure Muang Sai, Navarre managed to be on the airfield at Seno to see Puget off. Later on, it was alleged that Puget had jumped at Dien Bien Phu to atone for his commander's mistakes, and there is no doubt that some of his friends in the valley would ask him jokingly whether he did not now regret to have left his cushy job as Navarre's aide. But Puget had made his choice long before Navarre's star was waning, and, in coming to Dien Bien Phu, he simply shared the fate of his own battalion. What Puget saw at Dien Bien Phu was to leave a deep imprint for the rest of his life. When, at the end of the Algerian War, he felt that his concept of what the French army should be no longer matched that of the French government, he made another clean break with the past and left the army in order to be able to write about it. But on May 4, 1954, at 0200, Puget simply was another reinforcement for Dien Bien Phu. He had no trouble in finding the command post of the GAP, where Bijard told him to await dawn, to assemble his company, and then to take command of E3, with the primary mission of supporting the foreign legionnaires on E2. In the meantime, Puget followed the underground corridor to the Dien Bien Phu headquarters bunkers, where he met Seguin Passy and de Castries. The chief of staff, also a former cavalryman before he became a paratrooper, walked barefoot in the deep mud. De Castries used his cane to help himself pull his feet out of it at every step. As both men and some of the officers of their staff stood around the new arrival and asked him the same questions that all new arrivals were asked at every level, what was going on in Geneva, how far away was the Condor force, could large reinforcements be expected, would the Americans help, their discussion was suddenly interrupted by a call from H4. That strongpoint, held by Captain Luciani and an 80-man company of legionnaires and Moroccans, had been under attack since 0020, and it was probably the largest single enemy attack ever thrown against any of the strongpoints at Dien Bien Phu. Under the command of General Vuong Thoa Vu of the 308th People's Army Division, all of Regiment 86, Lieutenant Colonel Mon Quan, three more battalions from Regiments 88 and 102, and an additional battalion of the 312th Division, supported by the howitzers of Artillery Regiment 34. In all, a force of over 3,000 men had struck the tiny outpost. At the same time, the French artillery on Isabelle, which had begun to lay down a barrage around H4, was being blanketed by enemy interdicting fire. Incredibly, 2 hours later, H4 still held, although with serious losses. But the losses on the communist side were enormous, as hundreds of Viet Minh bodies covered the barbed wire west of H4. At 0300, the French radio operators at Dien Bien Phu began to pick up clear signs of confusion and panic on the Viet Minh side. The fact that both sides used American radio sets also played in favor of the French. According to the messages, the commander of the attack force, codenamed Tin, was being replaced by another commander named Ha. There also seemed to be shifts in the case of one regimental combat team commander and of one battalion commander. Still, the respite was enough to save H4. At 0335, the officers assembled in de Castries' underground headquarters became the silent witnesses to the end on H4, as a young lieutenant from the Moroccan platoon, apparently the last able-bodied officer on the position, Luciani himself had sustained a severe head wound a few minutes earlier, shouted into the radio set that there were still about 10 fighting men in the positions, but that the Viet Minh were penetrating his trench. His death cry, as the enemy assault teams shot him down, was clearly audible over the radio set. "You see," said de Castries to Puget, "there goes another strong point. There is nothing we can do about it. We are just constantly shrinking." But on Huguette, Major Guiraud was not giving up easily. Now, as experience dictated, was the best moment for a counterattack. The Viet Minh infantry did not yet know the conquered position too well, its artillery had not yet registered its new defensive fires, and was afraid of hitting its own men. On the French side, there was the rage at seeing one's own good friends die, and, with the growing daylight, the hope of getting close air support to replace the blanketed artillery and to neutralize at least part of the enemy's firepower. At 0600, the counterattack began, with paratroopers and Moroccans hastily scraped together from the remaining strongpoints of Huguette, supported by tank Auerstedt. But a counterattack of 100 men, no matter how fanatically motivated, against an enemy force of over 2,000, doesn't stand a chance. The sheer miracle of it was that the small band managed to fight its way forward through the communications trenches from H3 to H4, and actually reached the fringe of H4 before it was beaten back with heavy losses by the curtain of communist fire. As General de Castries had foreseen, H4 had been lost for good. Its loss cost the French 14 killed, including two officers, 58 wounded, and 150 missing, including one officer. On Isabelle, the day cost 2 dead and 30 wounded, including two officers. And there now were 1,260 seriously wounded soldiers in the underground hospitals. As dawn came, Puget wearily assembled his men in the open trenches of the 8th BPC on Sparrowhawk for the march across the battlefield and through the Nam Yum to E3. He had been observed by the enemy, and his progression was straddled by artillery salvos. It would take 3rd Company 6 hours to cover the short mile to its new position. It found E3 to be another walking hospital. There were 300 wounded lying in the various combat bunkers under the care of an airborne surgical team. The least wounded men were manning the automatic weapons. In grim silence, the new arrivals began to dig their own firing positions as the driving monsoon rain continued to fall on their shoulders and helmets. In the meantime, the senior officers at Dien Bien Phu also had drawn their conclusions from the events of the last 4 days. Obviously, the outside world, as it affected them, that is, General Navarre in Saigon and General Cogny in Hanoi, still had not made up its mind as to what to do with Dien Bien Phu. The trickle of airborne supplies and reinforcements indicated that there was no intensification of the air effort. As for the Condor force, its radio messages still came from the same location in Laos where it had been a week earlier. Only for the purpose of boosting morale was the rumor allowed to circulate that every day a strong French column from Laos was coming closer to bring relief and, perhaps, victory to the hard-pressed men at Dien Bien Phu. As for the American airstrikes, there had been no word of them in official communications for 10 days. In other words, the commanders at Dien Bien Phu knew on May 4th that the garrison was doomed, and the messages sent from Dien Bien Phu to Hanoi took on a brutal frankness which they had hitherto lacked, and also dealt with general questions which had not been broached before. Like Navarre and Cogny, de Castries also intended to put on record his view of the Battle of Dien Bien Phu. "When the Air Force talks to me about the risks encountered by the air crews, while every man here faces infinitely larger risks, there can't be any double standards. Airdrops must henceforth begin at 2000 instead of 2300. The considerable intervals between each plane flying night drop missions has ridiculous results in terms of tonnage dropped. Quantities which are dropped already represent only a fraction of what I request. That situation cannot go on much longer. I insist once more that I also be given a fairly large credit for decorations. I can't do anything to boost the morale of my men who are being asked to accomplish superhuman efforts. I don't even dare go see them with empty hands." But that was exactly what de Castries had finally done. Together with his chief of personnel, Lieutenant Colonel Troncar, and Colonel Longley, de Castries had visited Dr. Groen's underground hospital complex after weeks of being invisible to anyone but a few senior officers. Apparently, now that the decision-making at Dien Bien Phu was reduced to problems of day-to-day survival, de Castries began to reassert himself. Originally, the visit to the underground hospitals was to be limited to a perfunctory inspection of the main dugout. There, de Castries asked Groen to show him his most seriously wounded cases for the purpose of decorating them. Groen's answer was simply that everyone in here was most seriously wounded, whereupon de Castries overruled the objections of Troncar and Longley and undertook to visit literally every wounded in the hospital complex, no matter how remote the dugout or niche. He had no medals to hand out. Thus, the decoration ceremony was simply one of touching the man's shoulder and telling him that the citation would be entered in his record. Troncar walked silently next to the commander, taking down names and citations. The visit finally took all day. Among the last persons he saw was Lieutenant René Laguerre, one of the few survivors of the Viet Minh attack on E-1 two days earlier. Laguerre had received a shell fragment in his brain, and Groen had removed from his skull almost a cupful of destroyed tissue. But there he was, alive, his eyes blinking intelligently, but hemiplegic and mute. The less wounded men of his own company were taking care of him. At first, after his operation, Laguerre had violently refused to be placed into a wall niche. With his remaining movable arm, he had clawed his way out and was found several times lying in the mud of the communications trench. He was among the wounded directly evacuated from the battlefield after May 7th and miraculously survived. Months later, Groen met him in Saigon at Graal Hospital, where Laguerre was being trained like a small child to speak again. Groen asked him why he had repeatedly tried to leave his niche. Laguerre looked at him with his expressive eyes and said, slowly enunciating the syllables as if he were speaking a foreign language, "Because it was like a tomb, and I didn't want to die." The radio message which de Castries sent after his visit to the hospital clearly showed the impact of this experience upon him. In a long communication sent during the night of May 4th to 5th, he first detailed the troubles he was again having with the airdrops, but then added, "One must add, to all this, the continuous rain which causes the complete flooding of the trenches and dugouts. The situation of the wounded is particularly tragic. They are piled up on top of each other in holes that are completely filled with mud and devoid of any hygiene. Their martyrdom increases day by day. Indeed, that day, nearly every battalion reported that its dugouts were collapsing under the rain, and the men of the 31st Engineers were busy shoring up the surgical block of Airborne Surgical Team No. 5. To do this, the engineers now resorted to the dangerous game of crawling out every night on what was left of the airfield and tearing up the now useless pierced steel plates. Little is said in the records of their activity during that period, and even their own diary shows nothing but terse entries describing what would be normal engineering activities, until one remembers that those described here were being carried out under constant heavy artillery fire. On May 1st, 7 engineers were killed while collecting airdropped supplies. On May 2nd, 3 mining crews were laying a minefield and booby-trapping bunkers on H4, and the engineers, with one unarmored bulldozer, towed one of the disabled tanks from one position to another under constant fire. On May 5th, the engineers would once more enlarge the main hospital and dig new depot bunkers, and on May 6th, under constant artillery and small arms fire, they laid down new planking on both the Bailey Bridge and the Wooden Bridge crossing the Nam Yum. And 21st Company of the 31st Engineers, whose special charge was the electrical equipment, miraculously managed to keep electric power going day after day throughout the camp, rebuilding generator after generator from the parachuted spares or from salvageable parts of destroyed equipment. The same could be said for the signal personnel, who were constantly repairing smashed telephone lines and broken radio aerials. To the end, Dien Bien Phu did not suffer from lack of communications. At 1600 that afternoon, 2 French B-26 bombers again were hit by enemy flak. One was shot down over enemy territory, the other crash-landed in Laos. The C-119s immediately gained altitude. As a result, 3 out of 4 of them dropped their complete 6-ton loads into enemy lines. That day also, one last civilian telegram message reached Dien Bien Phu. It was addressed to the wounded Captain Michel Désiré on Isabelle by Madame Genevieve Désiré Villemine, his wife, and a noted African specialist. In fact, they had met a few years earlier in the Sahara, where he, as a lieutenant with the camel riders, tried to stop her from going off all by herself with a nomadic tribe. Madame Désiré Villemine informed her husband that she had given birth to a little girl. As they had agreed in advance, the little girl was given the name of the strong point for which Captain Désiré had fought with the tribesmen of 3rd BT, Amerie. Wednesday, May 5th, 1954. Shortly after midnight, artillery had provided supply with the account of shells fired during the previous day. 2,600 rounds of 105mm, 40 rounds of 155mm, and 1,180 rounds of 120mm mortar shells. At that rate of fire and the present level of airdrops, Dien Bien Phu would run out of artillery ammunition on the following day. And the rhythm of airdrops already announced another disastrous day. The rains were falling with the desperate regularity of the biblical floods, and by 0005, only 2 C-119s succeeded in making airdrops under good conditions, with all the others misdropping their loads. Finally, only about 40-odd tons of supplies actually fell within the perimeter. But there remained the parachute drops of personnel. Keyed up to the limit, Captain de Bazin and his battalion had now been sitting at Hanoi Airport for 3 days, awaiting a massive drop on Dien Bien Phu. Instead, the battalion was being dribbled in by bits and pieces, losing cohesion and combat morale. But that night, it had been de Bazin's turn, and at 0240, 5 French Air Force C-47s finally dropped 74 men into the rain-drenched furnace of the battlefield. They represented de Bazin's battalion headquarters and a few elements of 4th Company under Captain Jean-François Treyeux, yet another Breton paratrooper. As dawn came, Longley assigned de Bazin and his staff, along with the elements of 4th Company which had arrived, to join Captain Clédic on E4. But de Bazin never had a chance to take over his new command. A few hours later, an enemy shell crushed one of his legs. Captain Puget became the acting commander of the 1st BPC at Dien Bien Phu. In fact, while de Bazin and 4th Company went to E4, Puget was ordered by Bijard to relieve the remnants of Coutances 113 half-brigade on E2, while the wounded paratroopers, reinforced by some remaining Moroccans from the 14 RTM under Captain Nicot, would take over at the still quiescent E3. At about 1100, usually the quietest hour of the day, because that was when the Viet Minh relieved its troops and fed them their midday meal, Puget finally met Coutances in the wine cellar on top of E2. Long ago, E2 had lost all resemblance to anything human, and an incredible stench cloaked the whole hill like a thick blanket. As Coutances was to explain to his successor, there were probably 1,500 Viet Minh churned up on its few acres, not to speak of several hundred French paratroopers and foreign legionnaires. It will be recalled that Tank Basile, shot to pieces during the attack of April 1st, had crowned the hill with its distinctive shape. After a month of continued shelling and rain, it had begun to sink into the ground, and now formed a convenient bunker. With the departure later that day of the remaining legionnaires, with the exception of Coutances himself, who stayed overnight with Puget, E2 had now become the exclusive responsibility of 2nd and 3rd companies of the 1st Colonial Parachute Battalion. Captain Edma and his men had taken over the southeastern corner of E2 with its small bunker, while Puget and 3rd Company held on to the summit of E2. Somewhat below the crest of the hill, another bunker, deeply embedded among the roots of the banyan tree, which miraculously was still alive and seemed to be the last living shred of nature on E2, covered the line of communications which led from E2 via E3 to the Nam Yum. Here also, a Viet Minh trench tentacle had begun to grow in the direction of the banyan tree, and 3 communist death volunteers, loaded with explosives, had been shot down by French marksmen at the last moment and were now rotting in no man's land. In fact, in the upside-down world that the front-line trenches of Dien Bien Phu had become in the early days of May, it had become a sport for the legionnaire or paratrooper to crawl out into no man's land and bring back safely the 50 or 60 pounds of high explosives attached to the cadaver of one of the death volunteers. Not that anything could be done with the explosives on the French side. Indeed, they had to be prudently reburied far away from any of the combat positions. It was a gesture of pure bravado, of gratuitous defiance of fate, and duly appreciated as such by all concerned. There remained the problem of the mine shaft under E2. Captain Puget was to say later that Captain Coutances never informed him of the existence of the mine shaft, but according to a report written later by Staff Sergeant Chabrier of Captain Edma's 2nd Company, under whose position the mine shaft was precisely located, at least 2nd Company had been informed of the existence of the mine and of the fact that the Viet Minh had ceased digging in it for the past 2 days. But at dawn on May 5th, Chabrier again heard them digging and was very happy about it. Obviously, the Viet Minh were not yet ready to blow the mine shaft. Here again, a significant event, seen by 2 observers, has left different memories. Captain Puget, in his important work, does not recall that he had done anything to head off the explosion of the mine shaft on E2. On the other hand, Sergeant Chabrier recalls in detail that, because of losses due to enemy fire, Puget's 3rd Company took over part of the lower E2 area where the mine shaft was located, and Puget sent out a small commando patrol to attempt to blow up its entrance. According to Chabrier, that patrol was led by Sergeant Clinel. It was caught in the open by a communist outpost and destroyed to the last man. Clinel himself, according to Chabrier, managed to drag himself back to the French trench, only to die there. To the west, on Claudine, a small event that night was to have grave consequences. Since April 25th, Captain Schmitz of the 2-1 REI had held strongpoint C5 with his 2nd Company, reinforced by 1 platoon of Moroccans from the 14 RTM. That night of May 5th, the morale of the Moroccans finally broke. 5 of them, on guard duty in the forward trenches of C5, simply cut open the 2 separate systems of barbed wire entanglements in front of their position and slipped through them into the communist lines. Within minutes after their arrival, and before the legionnaires were aware of what had happened, communist automatic weapons began to take the breach under constant fire. Master Sergeant Kosanovich, Sergeant Lundquist of 3rd Company, and the whole platoon of legionnaires facing the gap desperately tried closing it, as they knew that, if it were to remain open, it would surely cause the eventual loss of C5. Kosanovich and 7 other men died in the attempt, and Lundquist and 12 other legionnaires were wounded. but the deserter's breach in the barbed wire remained unclosed. In a cold rage, the legionnaires disarmed the remaining Moroccans and kicked them out of their position. They promptly joined the rats of the Namyum in their burrows. At De Castries command post, the day had been one of relative calm and even apathy. With all infantry reserves fully committed and with ammunition levels at their lowest, there simply was nothing left to plan and direct, except the eventual breakout from Dien Bien Phu, for which Hanoi's authorization was required and had not yet been given. Such plans as had been made for Albatross were not discussed in order to preserve a maximum of secrecy and also in order to discourage any thought of not resisting at Dien Bien Phu until there existed no further hope of usefully holding out. But during the day, Dien Bien Phu reported without further comment that more and more underground dugouts and shelters were now collapsing from the rain. The command post also noted matter-of-factly that C-119 airdrops were particularly bad in spite of almost total absence of anti-aircraft fire. In the afternoon, Lieutenant Colonel Vallon, the artillery commander, decided to spend some of his remaining precious ammunition to disperse a strong concentration of Viet Minh infantry east of E-1, which seemed to be on the verge of launching a massive attack on the lowland positions of E-10 and E-12. The wounded Lieutenant Weinberger from the 1-2 REI had taken over command on E-12 that day and held the position with two weak platoons drawn from the least wounded legionnaires of his battalion. The French artillery paid for this brief activity with a steady communist counter-battery fire which began at 18:12 and lasted 4 hours. By the end of the day, Dien Bien Phu had lost 14 killed and 48 wounded, and there were the 5 fateful deserters from Claudine. On quiescent Juno, now also occupied by some of the remaining legionnaires of Captain Couton's 113 half-brigade, Sergeant Kubiak, late in the afternoon, crawled into the subway of the covered communications trenches to the signal depot near De Castries' command post, in order to obtain spare batteries for the remaining radio sets of his battalion. He got them, along with an electrifying piece of news. Colonel de Crèvecoeur's Condor force was only 50 kilometers away and would surely break through to Dien Bien Phu in a matter of days. Overjoyed, he retraced his steps back to Juno, shouting the news as he went along. On Juno itself, his own comrades did not seem to care. Happy to be away from the hell of E-2, they were sleeping. Sergeant Kubiak's buoyancy was not simply due to a naive young soldier's blind belief in what his superiors were telling him. Lieutenant Colonel Trancard, who witnessed the events from the vantage point of the command headquarters, but without being directly involved in them, confirmed that the weeding-out process of the bitter final battle had produced a combination of extraordinary physical misery and high combat morale among the remaining combatants. There was a clear realization that they, the last 3,000 men, the French and Vietnamese paratroopers, foreign legionnaires, and African cannoneers, literally represented all that stood between defeat and stalemate in the Indochina War. The main theme repeated throughout the shrinking fortress was, "They simply can't let us lose the war." That was to hold true to the very last minutes of the battle. Certain units simply refused to believe that it was all over, and there was a justified fear among the higher commanders that the battle would end in a general massacre of the garrison. There may have been another, more prosaic reason for the high morale of the remaining defenders. In view of the progressive lack of replacements for the casualties, many of the men remained on duty for days on end and were taking Maxiton, the French equivalent of Benzedrine. Finally, at 2100, De Castries received a brief personal message from General Cogny. It authorized De Castries to attempt a breakout when he felt that on-the-spot resistance had become hopeless. In the third paragraph, Cogny, in spite of the personal character of the telegram, employed a tone more likely to fit a later open record than to be of comfort to a beleaguered commander compelled to make an agonizing decision under pressure. "I need not underline inestimable value in every field, and perspectives offered by prolonging resistance on the spot, which at present remains your glorious mission." Thursday, May 6, 1954. May 6th began with the largest supply drop in almost 3 weeks. The French civilian pilots who had refused to fly the Dien Bien Phu runs on May 3rd now had returned to their airplanes, and the supply run was flown at almost maximum strength, 25 C-119s out of 36 available that day, and 25 out of 29 C-47s. The results were correspondingly high, as a total of 196 tons of supplies were dropped on Dien Bien Phu. Of course, they came by and large too late to do any good. Dien Bien Phu was now, as President Eisenhower aptly phrased it in his memoirs, reduced to a size no larger than a baseball field, and the supplies were largely falling outside the perimeter. Still, after the harsh remarks made during the previous days about the airdrops, there seemed to be a certain amount of warmth in a brief message from Dien Bien Phu to Hanoi at 5 minutes past midnight, in which the fortress simply said that now 6 119s launched their cargoes quite correctly. That left the personnel drop for the night. It began at 0412 in the face of extremely heavy communist flak. A dozen or so of Air Force C-47s were slowly circling the flaming valley, waiting for a momentary lull to dive into the circle, drop 4 or 5 men, and gain altitude again. These were still Frenchmen and Vietnamese of Headquarters Company and of the 2nd, 3rd, and 4th Companies of the 1st Colonial Parachute Battalion. At 0520, a total of 91 men had succeeded in parachuting in, but the rest of them, including all of 1st Company under Captain Fossurier, now returned to base. It had become too light to risk further personnel drops. In 4 nights of airdrops, the 1st BPC had succeeded in bringing in 383 men out of its total strength of 876 paratroopers. Here also, the number of Vietnamese included, even in those last desperate jumps, was impressive. Out of the 383 men who made the jump, 155 were Vietnamese. The 91-man contingent that jumped into Dien Bien Phu at dawn of May 6th was the last to reach it before the fortress fell. But early on the 6th of May, the situation inside Dien Bien Phu seemed far from desperate. A weak communist probe against E-3 had been easily repelled by a company of the 6th BPC. A more serious attack against H-3 and H-5 had been contained by the Foreign Legion paratroopers of Major Giraud. In 2 successive counterattacks, they cleared the enemy out of their forward trenches and held on to their whole position. But as the morning wore on, it became clear that General Giap was preparing his troops for a major attack. The latest set of aerial photographs clearly showed new approach trenches radiating out of D3 in the direction of what was left of the Alliance, and another net of new approach trenches emanating from Old Baldy and Phony Mountains, now gnawed away at the southern tip of E2. The mineshaft under E2 now had reached a total length of 47 meters. The scraping and hammering of the sappers had stopped altogether as long lines of unarmed coolies began to transport into the gaping hole almost 3,000 pounds of TNT. In the air also, the morning of May 6th had been favorable to the French. The rains had stopped for a while, and with both the American and French civilian pilots flying the supply runs, the French Air Force and French Navy bombers and fighters could concentrate entirely on flak suppression. Dien Bien Phu had never seen so many planes. 47 B-26 bombers, 18 Corsairs, 26 Bearcats, 16 Helldivers, and even 5 4-engine Navy privateers. This large aircraft deployment now effectively beat down the communist flak, and for once, the transport pilots willingly accepted the direction of Major Garand's air traffic control center inside Dien Bien Phu. That morning, many of the communist guns found it prudent to remain silent, so as not to reveal their positions, but finally, the day of reckoning had also come for the gallant Americans from civil air transport who were flying the supply runs. Piloting a C-119, Captain James B. McGovern had become a legend in Indochina, just as he had been a legend in China during World War II. A bearded man, and so huge, his nickname was Earthquake Magoon after a character in the Lil Abner comic strip, that he used a specially built pilot's chair, McGovern that morning flew a full load of ammunition. His co-pilot was Wallace Buford, another American, and the rest of the crew was French. Both men knew the Dien Bien Phu run well. In fact, that morning, McGovern was flying his 45th mission over the valley, and his wingman, Steve Cusack, with whom this writer had flown supply missions in Indochina in May 1953, was equally experienced. Thus far that morning, no plane had been hit seriously, and for once there was plenty of flak suppression from the military aircraft. Yet, as McGovern eased in for the final run over the drop zone, Steve Cusack suddenly heard his voice over the radio, saying, "I've got a direct hit." Indeed, one of the engines was squirting oil badly, and Cusack saw McGovern feathering it quickly. While serious, that incident was not as such fatal, since the C-119 is built with sufficient reserve power to keep on flying for a time on one engine. But another Soviet 37mm flak shell hit the stricken plane in one of its tail booms, and now the plane was badly out of control. With its 6 tons of ammunition aboard, the airplane was indeed a gigantic bomb, and its crash and explosion inside Dien Bien Phu would have been a major disaster. As McGovern and Buford wrestled with the controls of their plane, McGovern's voice could be heard asking Cusack to point out a low ridge, but it already was too late for any further maneuvering. It was difficult to tell later whether the words, "Looks like this is it, son," which Cusack heard from McGovern's plane, were addressed to him, who survived, or to Wally Buford, the co-pilot who died with McGovern a few seconds later when the heavily loaded plane cartwheeled and exploded in Viet Minh territory. At 10:00, Colonel Longley called together as many of the battalion commanders and other staff officers as possible for a briefing. The ammunition situation was serious, in spite of the fact that on this day no less than 70 tons of infantry ammunition and 50 tons of artillery ammunition, the latter largely 120mm mortar shells, had been slated for airdrop. But with few exceptions, nothing could be collected until nightfall because of the constant enemy machine gun fire and artillery harassment. And if the communists were to attack by then, the French would never have a chance of collecting that ammunition. Longley once more emphasized the external aspects of the battle. The Geneva Conference was progressing, and a ceasefire could occur any day. The Condor Force was almost within reach, and the French Air Force, if not boosted by a direct American intervention as expected under Operation Vulture, nevertheless had received a great many new aircraft, whose effect was bound to make itself felt on the enemy's frontline infantry, as well as his supply system. Captain Noel, the intelligence officer, carefully detailed the staggering personnel losses suffered by the Viet Minh divisions. But all this did not change the situation inside Dien Bien Phu. As of the time of the briefing, Lieutenant Colonel Vallant's artillery had less than 1 day's normal reserve, which usually could be fired in 3 hours if the going got rough, and there were no personnel reserves, not one platoon of 30 men. To be sure, there were the rats of the Nam Yum, but if they were used on the line, they would simply run away and leave a gap somewhere at the wrong moment, just as the deserters had done the night before on Claudine. If only the 493 remaining men of the 1st BPC could be airdropped during the following night, and the Viet Minh general attack could be held off long enough to collect a large part of the artillery ammunition, there was a chance yet of surviving the onslaught, just as Dien Bien Phu had survived the attacks on Beatrice, on Gabriel, on the northern Huguettes, and on Dominique. If one held this time, perhaps the Viet Minh would again take 2 weeks to reconstitute its units for yet another major attack. All that Dien Bien Phu now needed was another 12 hours of relative quiet. Just as the meeting was about to break up, a top-priority message arrived from Hanoi. Noel read it and passed it over to Longley, who in turn read it aloud to the assembled officers. French intelligence had a few months earlier succeeded in infiltrating the innermost circle of advisers around Ho Chi Minh himself, and had in recent weeks received remarkably accurate intelligence on crucial decisions made by the enemy. That important source had now informed the French that the general attack with the purpose of completely ending all French resistance at Dien Bien Phu was to take place as of the evening of May 6th. Dien Bien Phu would not have 12 hours to collect its ammunition and receive fresh airborne reserves. Captain Herbouet, the commander of the little tank squadron, who had had both forearms fractured during earlier operations, quickly walked over to Dr. Grouin and asked to have both plaster casts removed from his arms. He wanted to fight his last battle in the last remaining operational tank. Longley and Bijar, wearing red berets and no helmets, together crossed the bridge across the Nam Yum to inspect one last time the key defense positions on Elian. Longley, known throughout the whole theater for his love of strong spirits, almost every paratroop officer who had jumped into the valley had seen to it that his vest pockets would contain a small propitiatory flask for the commanding officer of GAP-2, had brought along with him a small bottle of cognac, which he now passed around in the command post dugout on E-4, where Brezhnev and Otella were commanding the whole eastern flank. As the final battle now approached, the commanders once more reviewed the order of battle. In the far north, Major Touré and the remnants of the 8th Parachute Assault Battalion were holding Sparrowhawk, D-4, and the nameless strong point in the drainage ditch. In the northwest, Major Giraud and perhaps 160 Foreign Legion paratroopers of the Composite Foreign Legion Parachute Battalion were holding on to the last shreds of Huguette, H-2 and H-3. Due west, Major Nicolas still held Lily 1 and Lily 2 with a mixed bag of Moroccans and watchful Legionnaires, while in the southwest, Major Clemenceau and Captain Coldbeuf were holding on grimly to all of Claudine, having thus far yielded nothing to the enemy. Due south lay Juneau, the hospital strongpoint. It was now commanded by Captain Charnot of the French Air Force and Captain Dulois, also referred to affectionately as Tonton, Uncle, Carabine. The actual fighting element on the position consisted of the still deadly Quad 50s of Lieutenant Redon, the shrinking Air Force detachment fighting as infantry, a small company of White Tie tribesmen of Dulois' old unit, and a small remnant of Captain Couton's 113 half-brigade, whose primary mission was to come to the immediate support of Elion in case of a catastrophe there. And then, of course, there were the now 602 wounded lying in Juneau's dugouts and trenches. Conveniently enough, Juneau was located directly next to Dien Bien Phu's cemetery. But it was on the Elions that Longley and Bichard had lavished their best remaining troops and commanders. On E4, Bréchignac and Botella, in addition to commanding the whole area, also commanded the last remaining shreds of the 5th Vietnamese Parachute Battalion and the 2-1 RCP. They were reinforced by the headquarters company of the 1st BPC under Captain Pendouf and the same battalion's 4th company under Captain Treu. On E2, Captain Puget commanded both the 1st BPC, the strongpoint, and his own 3rd company, while Lieutenant Edma and his 2nd company held the key southern bunker and trenches of E2. Elion 3, that morning, was still held by Legionnaires of the 113 and a North African platoon of the 14 RTM, soon to be reinforced by the rest of the battalion from Juneau, while the lower Elions, E10, 11, and 12, were held by a mixed force of paratroop remnants from the once-proud 6th BPC, regrouped around Major Thomas on E10. E11 and 12 were held by combat engineers, some Thai from 2nd BT, and some Algerians under Major Chanel. At noon, there were on the line on top of the upper Elions about 750 paratroopers who had been told that they could not expect any infantry reinforcements from inside the fortress, that there would be very little artillery fire to support them, and who were not even assured that there would be enough infantry ammunition if the fight were to go on for any length of time. With a heavy heart, knowing full well that some of their adieus would be final, Bijar and Longley returned to their own command post. It was about 1200. With clear skies overhead and the situation temporarily as well in hand as could be, Dien Bien Phu enjoyed a rare moment of respite, as if time had stopped. General de Castri used the time to reply via French radio channels to a telegram which President Eisenhower had sent him 2 weeks earlier to congratulate him and his troops for defending the cause of human freedom and for demonstrating in the truest fashion qualities on which the survival of the free world depends. The failure to even attempt the implementation of Operation Vulture, in one form or another, gave the words of the American president a certain hollow ring, which de Castri's reply perfectly matched. "I have been deeply moved by the expression of admiration, of gratitude, and of confidence that President Eisenhower was kind enough to send me on behalf of the American people. The free world may be assured that the defenders of Dien Bien Phu, whatever their origin, conscious of the fight they are waging, are determined to do everything in their power to continue to deserve this confidence and to fulfill right to the end the mission which has been entrusted to them." With the suddenness of an earthquake, a howling screech filled the air over Dien Bien Phu, followed within seconds by a series of explosions which rocked even the deepest remaining dugouts. Electric lights began to fail throughout the underground trenches, and in dozens of places wounded and bleeding men, their clothes torn off their bodies by the strength of the blasts, were frantically clawing at the beams and planks of collapsed shelters as they tried to dig themselves out or to dig their friends out before they died of asphyxiation. The echo of the first salvo had barely died down when a new ear-bursting screech filled the air, followed by yet another series of shattering explosions. For the first time in the Indochina War, the Viet Minh were using Soviet-made Katyusha six-tube field rockets, which the Russians already had used with devastating effect on the Germans during World War II. A crude weapon by today's standards, The Katyusha, fired from mobile launching racks, has a terrifying blast effect upon troops caught in the open, but would not normally be dangerous to troops in solid entrenchments. At Dien Bien Phu, the field fortifications had never been good, and those which had not yet fallen victim to communist conventional artillery had been very badly undermined by the monsoon. Upon them, and upon the remaining non-European French troops, who had never heard a noise approaching that of the field rockets, the effect was devastating. Throughout the camp, depots began to explode and to burn. All the major medical stocks were destroyed that afternoon. Uncollected ammunition packages from the airdrops added their secondary explosions to those of the rockets, and by the end of the afternoon, Claudine 5 reported that 3/4 of all its bunkers had been completely destroyed and that its trenches had been smashed flat or buried under the explosions. At 17:30, the conventional communist artillery began to lay down a heavy barrage on E4 and E2. On both hills, all men save those in the most essential outposts burrowed deep into trenches and bunkers. There was nothing else to do now but to await the assault. At 17:30, the main position at Dien Bien Phu had exactly one more day to live. The last night. A remnant of daylight still hung over the hilltops of Elion when the final attack began. As the barrage increased in intensity, Breshignac had radioed Puget that the attack would in all likelihood aim at E2 first. "But don't worry," said Breshignac. "You've got at your disposal whatever there is left of the artillery, and I might even get you a small company of reinforcements." Lieutenant Robin, the artillery forward observer on E2, who had served an incredible continuous 3 weeks on it and knew the area well, meticulously went over his fire charts. There were too few shells around to waste through errors of calculation. At about 18:45, the whole eastern slope of E2 suddenly seemed to come alive as the first wave of 1,000 Bodoy emerged from the approach trenches. For that key attack, General Giap had chosen Lieutenant Colonel Wu Yen's Infantry Regiment 102 of the 308th People's Army Division, the Iron Division of his army. The 102nd was indeed the crack regiment of perhaps the whole Viet Minh Army, and proudly bore the title of Capital Regiment, which it had earned for its stubborn defense of parts of Hanoi against masses of French troops and armor from December 1946 until March 1947. It now had a key role to play face-to-face with Captain Puget's small band of elite French paratroopers, and it was going to play it to the hilt. On the French side, there was a moment of total silence. In Puget's dugout, the voice of Lieutenant Robin could be heard clearly as he asked for the laying down of the artillery barrage, and just as clearly one could hear in reply the voice of the fire control officer a few hundred yards away beginning a reverse count. 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4. With seemingly a single roar, the remaining howitzers and heavy mortars of the main position fired a salvo into the unprotected mass of humanity on the slopes of E2. Several more salvos slammed into Regiment 102, then the forward observer called for a halt. When the smoke cleared, the Viet Minh assault wave had vanished. From E4 and E2, the paratroop outpost's field glasses counted at least 200 bodies lying still on the churned-up ground. As Puget would put it later, the thought of that massacre would keep the paratroopers cheered up as they now steeled themselves to face the reprisal artillery bombardment that was sure to come. And it came indeed. With a vengeance, the whole gamut of enemy artillery, from 75mm recoilless rifles and 81mm mortars to medium howitzers and Soviet rocket launchers, now began to lay down its devastating fire on the whole French central position. Within a short time, three of the remaining 105mm howitzers were destroyed and their gun crews killed. At the same time, the enemy batteries near Isabelle began to hammer away at the latter strongpoint's guns. By 2300, Colonel Lalande reported 8 of his 9 howitzers as destroyed. With them disappeared all chances of effective defensive fires for strongpoints Claudine and Duguette. The results of the bombardment became particularly obvious on Claudine 5, already badly mauled by the artillery barrage of the previous hours. Caught in the open, unable to find even the modest protection offered on Elion by the reverse slopes, 3rd Platoon of 2nd Company, 1-2 Foreign Legion, began to pull back its outposts from the deserters' breach in the barbed wire at about 1900. By 2200, C-5 was disintegrating, and its last remnants attempted to hold the communications trench system west of C-2 and C-4. The battalion commander, Clemenceau, decided to strip the remaining position of every man who could be spared in order to hold C-5 as long as possible. Captain Philippe, who commanded a mixed company of remnants of the 313th on Clavin 4, sent a platoon over to C-5. But in the absence of any artillery support, there was very little that it could do. It soon found itself engulfed in the general debacle of 2nd Company. But then, the platoon of sappers of the 12REI pushed forward. In a Foreign Legion parade, which is colorful enough, the sappers themselves represent an unforgettable sight. Chosen from the tallest and biggest men in the outfit, they all wear full beards and a gleam.